This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on May 18th, 2012. And today we are talking to some of the guys from GitHub. We're talking to longtime friend of the show, Phil Hack. Welcome back, Phil. And his cohorts, Paul Betts, or as I always think of him, ex-Paul Betts X, and Tim Clem. If you didn't get that,
great to meet you guys.
That's because of his Twitter handle.
How's it going?
So, yeah, thanks for coming on, guys. And we're going to talk a little bit today about Git and GitHub, and more specifically about GitHub for Windows, an exciting new product that I think a lot of people have been waiting for. So I think a lot of listeners would know the basics about Git and GitHub. Do you guys just want to give the like 30-second spiel?
Yeah, absolutely. I can do that. So if you haven't been to github.com, it's a website that does, at its base premise, code hosting, but we kind of added this collaborative model on top of it, which allows you to basically take any project that you're interested in and create your own fork and start hacking away on changes and then submit those back to the owners. So more of a ask forgiveness instead of permission model of doing development, which has really taken off and kind of exploded in the open source world and has turned out to be quite useful as well for internal and closed source development for a whole variety of companies. So I think we're pushing 1.6 or 1.7 million users and 3.5 million repositories hosted there now. And the growth has been pretty explosive the past couple of weeks. So.
Now, Git came originally out of the Unix world, but it has certainly been adopted more widely than that. What's the current story about running Git on Windows, and why are there some pain points there?
Well, I guess I would say it was really a tool kind of developed by Linux kernel hackers, and as such kind of started off in this world of command line and, you know, obtuse parameters they're passing on the command line and a very textual-based interface. And I think that has ultimately been its biggest challenge in transferring to Windows and even some other operating systems, is that many people are, first of all, hesitant to install Unix tools on their Windows computer. And then when they do, it's a very foreign way to interact with your computer. You make a commit message and you end up in a editor called VI, in which I doesn't actually type an I key and there's no way obvious to quit. And so you kind of close the window and say, maybe I won't use this Git thing because it kind of seems difficult or foreign to me. So part of what we've really tried to do in bringing GitHub for Windows out into the world is make that process a whole lot easier and basically let anybody on Windows participate on GitHub and use Git in a much more seamless and easy fashion.
So when I have used Git on Windows, I mostly have used a product called msysgit. So who owns that currently? Who maintains that? Do you guys participate in that product or is that somebody else?
So it's owned by the open source community and we participate in it. We talk on the mailing list with the people. We haven't had to change it much, to be honest. One of the good things about Git is it's very customizable, right? And so we haven't had too many needs to actually change how it works from a code standpoint, because one of the things we do in GitHub for Windows, ship our own, I guess you call it a distro of msysgit. So msysgit, most people don't know, comes with a bunch of settings that are like the system settings, right? In a Linux box, it'd be in the etc directory, right? And because GitHub for Windows ships its own, we can control those settings. And we set them in a more Windows-friendly way. So it a lot of the things that we want to do with Git, we don't have to actually ask to change code. We just customize Git to be more awesome for Windows. And we wrote a few like little utility programs, like a program I wrote called Gitpad, which makes it so that instead of opening VI, like Clem mentioned, it opens whatever opens text files. By default, it's Notepad. So you always have Notepad. If you use like Notepad++ or Sublime Text, it'll open that and you can write your commit message there, right? Little tiny programs that make the experience way better. They weren't hard, but because we're more focused, our audiences, not everyone, including the Linux people on Windows, we can make a better experience.
Now, is GitHub for Windows for using Git with GitHub specifically, or is it can be used as a general purpose Git client?
You can use it as a general purpose Git client, but it's optimized for GitHub. So when you log in, you'll see a list of your GitHub repositories. You can clone them locally. If you go to github.com, you'll see a nice clone in Windows button if you happen to be browsing from a Windows machine. And if you click that button and you have GitHub for Windows install, we'll just go ahead and clone that into your existing instance, and you can get started on that repository. If you want to use it with something like CodePlex or Bitbucket, you can use the git command line that we include and clone it locally following the instructions on, you know, whatever site it is. And once you have that local clone, you can actually drag it into GitHub for Windows, and we'll track it as a repository. And you don't get all the features that we have, but you can pretty much make commits, view history, all that stuff. And when you're ready to push, you can also push. And what's nice is, if you, we'll ask you for your credentials. You should be using an HTTPS for that. And when you enter your credentials, store them for you, so you don't have to keep entering every time you try to push the server.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about the app itself. Like, what, give us the flavor of what this thing can do, and maybe I've used GitHub for Mac. I mean, some other people probably have too. Is it sort of a Windows version of that, or does it have unique features just for Windows? What's the overall view?
I would say the products are very similar to each other. But we definitely set out with trying to create something that felt very at home and very native on Windows. So the core feature set is close to identical with some key differences. And the biggest thing that we do is just we're really making the distribution of Git a core part of the application. We kind of expect a lot of people don't want to install Git on their own or aren't to be bothered with doing things like setting up SSH keys so that they can clone from GitHub. And so we kind of take care of a lot of those really hard Unix-y paradigms that for a Mac user isn't quite as necessary or is something that's a little bit more a part of the base OS. But in terms of individual features, I mean, you can look at repos, you can clone repos. We've replaced push and pull merge with just a sync button. So you don't have to worry about that back and forth workflow with a server. You just kind of stay in sync with that repository as you make commits to it. Show you branches, let you create branches, you check them out, you can publish them to GitHub, you can unpublish branches from GitHub. You can do merges within the app and all of that kind of good stuff. So it definitely doesn't do everything, and I think that's part of the reason we've really also focused on making it easy to pull up a PowerShell instance from within the context of a repository in the app, so that if you're really needing to do a an interactive rebase or one of these more powerful Git commands, we want you to be able to do that as well. Or if you just want to actually learn more about Git and kind of discover some of the power of the command line.
So we talked before with Phil and Paul, and one of the things we talked about was, you know, some of the difficulty of just installing things, getting things set up. And it's very obvious from installing the app from the beginning that you put a lot of effort into making it, you know, a seamless install and setup. And I'm wondering, you know, aside from just installing an a desktop client, are there other things that are important as part of the install that are, making things smooth and seamless for me as a developer?
No, we try to take care of everything. So if you install GitHub for Windows, you get GitHub, you get Git, you get PoshGit comes with it. We set up your profile so you don't have to. The whole idea was that you don't have to walk around to the five different places and, you know, go to a website and set up keys. You really just install an application, type in a username and password, and you're good to go.
And the app experience, the install experience, we really tried to pull away a lot of the choices that you have to make with the traditional MSysGit installer, which is choosing things about editing your path and what kind of line ending munging you want. And so we really made just some opinionated decisions about a lot of those things. And because we live in our own sandbox, we don't have to really worry about your global path and that kind of thing. And then in terms of the update experience, I would say we aren't fully there, but we're much closer to the kind of Chrome, almost a web app experience. You know, the versions basically come down and install themselves. And by the time you know about it, it's already downloaded and installed. And all it's telling you, you know, next time you restart the application, you're going to be on the very latest version. So the hope there is that we can kind of push the iterative development of that product a lot faster than you would traditionally be able to push a native application. And that's everything from pushing out features to being able to fix bugs and that kind of stuff. I think that's beneficial to everybody.
I'm curious what you use to build the application.
Well, a whole bunch of stuff. So we worked hard to, leverage existing open source technologies. I can let Paul talk about kind of his pieces he pulled in a bit. But one of the big projects that GitHub has been working on and something I've been involved with here for a year or two now is this library called libgit2, which is a re-implementation of core Git as a linkable library. It's actually something that can use a standard API and write other programs against it. The reason you can't do that with core Git is it's started off as a bunch of, you know, Perl scripts and C extensions, and it calls exit and die all over the place. So if you write a program that links to it, you also die. And so libgit2 is this really nice cross-platform C API. You know, there's no necessity of installing a POSIX environment on Windows that provides feature compliant Git access. And part of that, there have been some great strides in binding development. So the bindings we use are libgit2 sharp, which is just a stellar way of interacting with a Git repository compared to shelling out to the command line and parsing text. You can list branches and query through the reflog and all sorts of really interesting things that you can do with an API or with a real API, as opposed to, you know, calling a command line utility and trying to parse the response. So those are that's one of the more exciting components in there. Maybe Paul can talk a little bit about some of the stuff that he brought in terms of frameworks and the application.
Sure. So for a long time now, I've always been a desktop app developer. Like, that's the thing that has really interested me. It's an awesome place to be in 2012, for sure, with the web. It's the desktop's coming back, trust me. totally. It's gonna happen, guys. I look at Rails and I'm like, that Rails is really awesome. Like, why don't we have a framework that's like opinionated and has conventions and makes it as easy to write desktop applications as it is for web applications? And I certainly haven't gotten there yet, but that's kind of like my holy grail, the thing that I've always been interested in. And so one of the big pieces of it is this library I wrote called Reactive UI, which uses the Reactive extensions, which is this Microsoft framework that hurts people's brains a lot, but it's really cool. And it takes a lot of the corner cases and like, oh, I clicked and got in a weird state and now my app doesn't work out of it. And so we really use Reactive UI a lot in GitHub for Windows. One thing that was really interesting to me early in the project was this every application uses that is interesting today, you know, 2012, is going to talk over a network, right? It's going to talk to an internet service. And any application that's going to do that is obviously going to do some sort of caching, right? It's going to save as soon as you hit like downloading images, right? Like, we download the avatars for each user who does a commit, right? Then we need to think of a framework to make this work well. And I didn't want to, we're doing it one off, kind of like caching domain objects in one cache, and we're using image caching for a different cache. And then they have all these kind of different interesting policies. Like, for images, for example, you want to always load from disk, but every once in a while you want to try to refresh it to see if they have a new image. But you always want to display something, right? You don't want to like say, oh, this image is old, I'll just display a big question mark and then load the new one, right? But not every object wants to be like that. Like, some information, if it's old, it's useless. So being able to streamline these kind of like policy and common use cases was really interesting. And so we wrote this library called Akavash, which we actually released on the blog and made public. It's an open source library, and it ideally works on Windows Phone, Silverlight, Window, like WinRT, WPF, and Mono. The Windows Phone is kind of a little bit broken at the moment. But hopefully that'll be working soon. And I think that it's a really interesting library. And it's kind of like the one place that the GitHub for Windows would, when we started using that everywhere, it was kind of changed how we wrote the application. Really cool.
So one of the differences between using GitHub for Windows to manage your Git projects and interacting with GitHub is that it doesn't do pull requests. I don't think. Last time I checked, it didn't. So not only it doesn't do pull requests for non-GitHub projects, but it also doesn't pull requests against GitHub yet, does it? And that's just because you got to re-implement the world in the lib, what is it, libgit sharp? No, libgit2.
Yeah, well, libgit2 and then libgit2 sharp. And I think, so, you know, a pull request is something that GitHub kind of coined the term. It actually came out of mailing lists and that kind of stuff. But the pull request is really a collaborative web activity. So, you know, we don't support creating a pull request from the application, but we definitely support, you know, creating a feature branch and pushing that to github.com. And the way we use pull requests at GitHub is it's not necessarily something that's finished yet. It's something that you have made an implementation and you're ready to talk about it. You want some feedback, you want a code review, you want to show people what the interface looks like and maybe fight out a little bit about some of the implementation details and performance aspects of a change. So I think GitHub for Windows will always have to walk this line of what is appropriate for a desktop application to be doing and what is really best suited to the web and should really be pushed on GitHub.com as the primary place to interact, you know, have a conversation about code with your team or with the world of open source. So,
and I think that this is not a promise of future features by any means, but the way that you interact with things in the desktop is different than on the web. Like, for example, making a fully blown like issue browser, like cloning exactly what's on GitHub issues would be kind of silly. But one thing that would be really interesting, for example, is like if you're a desktop app, you're in a good place to pop up like toasts and notifications, right? So what if I got notified when new bugs came in or new pull requests or stuff like that, right? Like how can we complement the web instead of trying to just re-implement it?
So GitHub for Windows is a WPF app, and they're, as I've seen, not really that many of those out there. I'm curious as to, was that an obvious decision for you guys, or was that a point of discussion?
That's a good question. I think it was a fairly obvious decision to us, partly based on our skill set, but also trying to be forward-looking in technology and understanding there's a lot of C# and .NET open source development that happens on GitHub. An actually surprisingly large amount of really interesting projects and great things to build on top of. It certainly makes for a much more elegant, maintainable application as opposed to really dropping into C++ or some of those other languages that require a little bit, you know, more diligence and a larger team and aren't necessarily going to work. You know, we're able to basically support Windows XP through Windows 8 release candidates with this single release of the application, which can be considerably harder to do in other platforms, technologies. Not to say that WPF isn't without its issues and its challenges, but from a visual standpoint, I think what we loved the most was GitHub brings design into everything. We had full-time design working with us really from day one when I kicked off application development. And basically being able to always say yes is kind of an amazing thing. Like designers are very used to coming up with things and then developers saying, well, that's difficult and you don't understand the implications of that. And I feel like more often than not with WPF, I'm always basically able to say, awesome, like we can do that. Absolutely. We can make that happen. Let's play with this idea. Let's refine it. There's no reason why that can't be possible in this application.
Can you talk a little bit more about how that works? Like, were you getting Photoshop, you know, was it Photoshop level interaction with designers, or was it kind of like, hey, how does this look to you guys? Yeah, no, move this over here. Or, you know what I mean? Because I'm always curious with that, that, you know, more kind of pixel perfect saying yes to the designers. How did you work that out?
Absolutely. Like anything at GitHub, you generally have to convince somebody else that what you want to do is a good idea. And so when I started working on this project, I started trying to sell, you know, the idea of building a Windows app to a couple of the designers at GitHub. And the Metro UI was really the thing that started to catch people's attention and kind of brought me further into conversations. And the guy, Cameron McKeffie, who actually ended up doing the majority of the kind of raw design work on the Windows application, is originally a print designer. He builds a bunch of the Octocats. He does some of the design on GitHub.com, but his background is really in print media. And so he kind of fell in love with this really blank slate canvas and the grid system of Metro and some of these Swiss design principles that are encapsulated in the style. And so we really started going back and forth. I actually did sketches. So I have basically a journal or a notebook where I did kind of initial sketch mockups of the app. And Cameron and I would kind of go back and forth about how we wanted to present information and these kind of things and how we wanted to differentiate ourselves from GitHub for Mac. And then he would go off and build very high fidelity mocks in Photoshop that we would sort of iterate on. And I would end up actually, in some cases, duplicating those mocks in XAML. And so at that point, they weren't really mocks. They were actually fidelity interfaces. And Cameron would build, you know, the seven states of the button and all the colors and that kind of thing. And I would go back and be able to actually build an interactive button in XAML. And we would sit down and we would kind of talk about what felt right and what didn't work and how some things in Photoshop didn't transfer well into XAML and what he would do next time. And so it was a very, design is a really iterative process at GitHub and can be, I think, a little bit intimidating to people new because we're often very harsh with what we like and what we don't like. And the encouragement is basically to like get something out there as soon as possible and play with it. Like we don't they're not separate teams. We sit next to each other on a daily basis, share code and screenshots. And ultimately, you know, I say, no, that'll never work. You got to do this, he says, but your margins don't line up. I insist that, you know, this look like this. And so it was a very, in my mind, it was a very beneficial process. And in the end, I think, you know, the application speaks for itself, and its design had really came together. Someday I should go find the, you know, the original notebook sketches and then my early prototypes. And Cameron and I probably went through, I don't know, maybe a dozen different implementations of even just the dashboard of the app before we arrived at what it is now.
And how did, you know, I'm curious your overall impressions on Metro as a, like, was it kind of more just like a general inspiration? I mean, I've seen people interpret Metro in different ways as kind of like it's a theme, or some people dig way into the guidelines and specs. And then also I'm curious too, I've seen some discussion on Twitter from different people about, you know, I know Kelly Summers said, you know, she wanted to see it be more vibrant and more, you know, but on the other, I kind of like this simple feel to it. I don't know. I just wondered if you can talk more about the overall feel of.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, from the very beginning, I wanted it to be Metro, but I also wanted it to really feel like GitHub. And I think if you pull GitHub.com up next to the application, they're two very different things, but there's some really strong ties between them. And the, you know, the white space and the design of the application and even the feel of the buttons and the avatars, for instance, we custom designed the kind of default avatars. If you don't have an avatar or your org doesn't have an avatar, those were designed for the app, for GitHub, for Windows, and actually ultimately are now the default avatars on GitHub.com because we liked them so much. And so there's this real synergy between the way the two things look. And I think that's part of, we talked a lot about GitHub flavored Metro. So we wanted to take Metro, but we really wanted to steer it towards GitHub's basic design tools. And I think it came out well. I loved, you know, Kelly came in and had this just brilliant, you know, out of everyone who participated in our beta and submitted a bug report, hers was the only one who really critically thought about the design. And while I didn't feel like her designs were really in the style of GitHub, I really appreciated that, like, the critical eye. Like, she really went in and, like, thought hard about all the interface elements and thought hard about, and her Metro actually may be closer to what Microsoft defines Metro as than what we took it at. But I appreciated that kind of critical eye on it.
I think it's definitely more than a theme, right? If you treat Metro as just a theme, then you end up with Visual Studio Beta, which is, which was really nice for us because we were starting at the beginning, right? And so, you know, Visual Studio has this huge, like, people know how to use Visual Studio. And if you change completely how it works, you'll be wrong in a different way. Because we could, from the beginning, think about, like, content over the Chrome kind of principle and not make the Chrome be so important in terms of how to actually get stuff done, we really could kind of do a really good job with the Metro stuff. We got a lot of inspiration, I guess, from Zune, the Zune UI, the kind of the way that uses typography. And I'd like to even go a little further. Like, I really like, for example, in Zune, how you pull up an artist in the background, it shows like a picture of, like, it uses this really interesting photo, even though you can say that Metro is all about, like, flat colors and, like, typography. But in the interim, one of the things I think we could do better on for GitHub is, in some way, I'm not sure how, but like, they always had these really interesting photos in the background. And Kelly called that out when she had these really interesting, like, vibrant photos as the background photo. It's, like, hard to think of, like, you can't really just use the Octocat for everything, but like, it's definitely something interesting. Like, it's better than, you know, Battleship Gray and, like, making a typical developer tool. So it's really cool to work on because you can be creative, which is.
So one of the things that I kind of noticed when I was working with the beta, aside from all of my usual Scott problem, was that the UI it was a desktop app, but it was very web oriented. I think you talked briefly about that when we talked about the design principles in it, but it wasn't really offsetting to me. I mean, it wasn't off-putting, I guess, but it was still kind of hard to get used to. Mm-hmm. Like, some things I expected to behave desktop-y, like being able to right-click in a context menu to do stuff, mm-hmm. or to hover over things and have, you know, other things happen, or to be able to, like, you can drag and drop in some places, but not others. Like, when you want to add the repositories onto it, you know, it's a lot easier than saying, scan my whole system, you just say, oh, I'll add these in, mm-hmm. in some cases. And that, so I wonder, what's the difference between making a desktop app desktop-y versus webby? And so, I guess, what's the trade-off?
And Paul and I will probably go separate ways on this because he's in love with desktop applications. But my kind of personal opinion on this is that, you know, both sides of the world are coming together here. And you talk about, you know, you basically can't build a desktop app today that doesn't talk to the web in some form, who's using a REST API or web service of various sorts. And in many ways, you can't build a web application today without starting to pull in what traditionally were just desktop interaction, you know, drag and drop and some of these things that really have been only confined to native clients. And so what I think you're going to see is that these two different ways of writing applications is going to start meeting in the middle somewhere, where my desktop application is something that's delivered over the web, but once I install it the first time, I'm never actually aware that it updates itself more. And so in that way, it is a little bit closer to a web application. And then in the other form, you know, the web apps are starting to come down to the point where there's a whole lot more local caching. There's a lot of work being done by local JavaScript, and there's some better APIs for interacting with other pieces of your system so that app in a browser feels much closer to something that's running natively on your system. And ultimately, I think that's very beneficial. I mean, I think we kind of want to pull a little bit of the best of both those worlds out of there. And part of that means bringing in user interface paradigms from both the web and the desktop so that people like you switch between GitHub for Windows and GitHub.com, and there should be some very similar familiar interface paradigms. So you don't really right-click on GitHub.com. And while we do support that in a couple places in the application, it's never the primary means of doing anything in the app. So
yeah, and I think it's tricky because it's like when you're writing a desktop application that has a new kind of interface or like something novel or interesting, that you're kind of like balancing this between like, you know, familiarity and like, you know, people have a lot of expectations. A lot of them you don't think about when you're writing desktop applications, like how do I move the window if there's no window title, right? Like originally we had, you know, the first like 20 pixels at the top acted like a kind of invisible window title that you could drag around. But we found that a lot of people would be like, how do I move this window? So a lot of tricky things like you don't think about until you break them. And then people are like, this doesn't work right. But it's, you have to kind of balance between being progressive and coming up with something new and interesting versus how people use this thing they've used for the last, you know, 10, 20 years.
I also think, you know, some of those elements, you know, you're starting to see things become touch friendly. And I'm not necessarily convinced that developers are going to, you know, be touching their screens to do development and make commits in Git. But I can certainly see an argument for, you know, basically browsing source code or catching up on what the team has been doing. And if I can write a desktop app in a way where it is, you know, I can use it on a Slate or on a Windows 8 touchscreen, I think that's very beneficial. And some of those paradigms like right-click or some of the traditional desktop Chrome, it really kind of falls apart when you're living in a world of touch. And so I think it's good to start questioning some of those base principles of interface design and even some of those base aspects of the Chrome and the OS, which I think are starting to become sort of relics of a different age. So.
So I was curious about the whole installation system, and from a user and somebody, I popped it up in an iLSpy, and some things I noticed: one, click once, which is cool, and then two is that the github.exe is less than 3 meg, and there's a GitHub portable Git that's 30 meg and has a bunch of 7-zip files in it. Can you talk more about how that's all the magic behind the scenes?
Sure. So the magic behind the scenes that right now will probably change in the near future, because click once is really awesome. And like, it's really a bummer because they got like 95% of the way there and then put just enough like glaring bugs in it that it caused a lot of problems. Things like Scott having problems with his caching proxy server cached a little bit too aggressively. And so he didn't get updates anymore. So there's nothing we could do about that. Click once was this black box. And so because we use ClickOnce, ClickOnce doesn't really like shipping anything but DLLs and exes, right? It actually doesn't like shipping exes either. It only really wants to ship one. So what we did was we embed all of portable Git and a bunch of other libraries. We embed actually all of Chrome in DLLs as resources. And so when we start the application, it really works way more like a Mac application in the sense that we don't have custom code in the installer, right? Because we can't, because it's ClickOnce. So really the first time you run the application, we do what you would normally do during setup. We expand a bunch of stuff out. We create a bunch of directories under local app data that store these things like the current version of portable Git. And if you run the app, you'll see, if you click fast enough, you'll see a progress bar go across the screen as we expand that out. And so we use 7-zip because we really wanted to keep this. We tried to
with some amount of success, keep this download as small as possible, though distributing all of Git and all of Chrome makes that a little tricky. And so that's the idea, is that we 7-zip everything up and then hide it in a resource, and then we expand it out. We have a class to like manage like versions, like as you upgrade, we can blow away old versions and bring up new ones and stuff like that.
Interesting side note, but on 7-zip, I heard that Silverlight used that as well to keep the install under 5 meg or whatever it was. I heard it on some public podcast at one point that that's what they did to make it tiny.
Yeah, you can really, like, if you turn up the compression really high, you can do far better than zip. At the cost of your expand time and view requirements go to the roof, right? But if you want it to be small, then 7-zip, good job.
So then how does that update process work? You said click once doesn't solve all that for you. Are you manually going out and pinging a server and pulling things down? Or, you know, how do, as we were talking, I updated mine and it had a little blue arrow that was showing me I had an update and it just magically worked.
So ClickOnce does a lot of the work of updating the application itself. So the actual our actual EXEs and DLLs, like ClickOnce does that. And you can actually, like, ClickOnce has a client-side API that nobody uses, but it actually makes the experience far better if you can do things like you disable that stupid startup thing that displays the ugly, like, computer transferring something over a network window.
Oh, wow. So Chrome could do that too then.
Yeah, you can turn that off, right? Kind of. There are certain situations where it'll still come up and you can't make it permanently go away, but you can mostly make it go away. And so we're really pushing ClickOnce around to tell it what to do. And then we know where there's an update. The one thing that ClickOnce doesn't do is change logs. And so we have to do change logs manually. So we just pull it by hand. And then to update, so if you have an old version of portable Git and then our version of portable Git, and then you update the app, we have to say, like, what's the version that's embedded in my resource? What's the version that's on the disk? Are these the same? If not, I need to blow it away and re-extract it out. And the same with, like, Chromium and PostgreSQL, for example, are other things that we distribute in the same way. And that's all by hand. There's no ClickOnce doesn't help with that.
Now, I remember on Jabber at one point you mentioned this in-sync library that you were talking about. Is that the idea of at some point making this more general?
Yeah, so I'll talk about in-sync solely because that'll force me to do it, because it'll be even more public. So I'm really kind of re-implementing ClickOnce, basically, at least the idea of it. And so in-sync was kind of in the Code52 chat room, and I was like, I really need a name for this project. I can't think of anything. And there's like the existing projects are like an apt update, and like there's a few others. But of course, you know, every .NET project starts with N, and they're like, well, you know, you're and the thing that I was really interested in was the update process, right? Like checking my version against the upstream version and like syncing down the packages, right? And so it's like, oh, just call it in-sync. And then AOS came up with a logo. Like bitmap. And after that, I was like, yep, we gotta do it. Gotta do it. And so the idea is it's all based on NuGet. It's really abusing NuGet to distribute app updates. And so it actually takes your EXE and then takes all the DLLs you depend on and then puts it into a NuGet package. Because NuGet, the cool thing about NuGet is that tools know about it, and it's a really simple format to work with. Like, it's just a zip file. And the NuGet core DLL will manipulate them for you, right? So I didn't even have to write code to like parse the new spec file. Like, it just did it for me. And so basically what we're doing is we're using that to like send down from the server to the client app update. And the cool thing is if the server, quote unquote, can just like NuGet, it can be just a folder full of files. So you don't have to run a custom server. Or ClickOnce, you don't technically have to run a custom server, but if you serve up certain files if you don't serve up the right MIME type, then ClickOnce refuses to look at it. So really the goal of in-sync is to be an installer that's like developer friendly. Every other installer I've ever used is like a developer nightmare to set up, especially if you want to set it up for production versus just like a, you know, create an EXE. And it's really, the idea is to be as developer friendly as possible, but still be a production quality solution. So I think it's really cool. Like I've started working on it a little bit, but before I started, I wrote out the entire spec of what it should do. And so I think it has some cool pieces to it. And it's really like, it's one of those things where like you didn't plan it, but like all the different aspects just are coming together really well. Like how NuGet, you know, I can create like a package that's, I call a Delta package, which is like just the differences between two updates, but it's still a NuGet package because it still has the same metadata. which is really cool, because if the as long as any of the none of the tooling actually pokes into that package, it can still treat it like a NuGet package, even though it's kind of a broken NuGet package. But I think it'll be cool. I'm really excited about it. So
it's awesome. One of my big requirements for it was really like having control over the when a user clicks download your app, like as a developer and a designer, I should be in control at that point. And Click Once does an okay job, but it's still there are so many dialogues, so many questions. Even if you ratchet everything down to the bare minimum, it still is this like click fest of all of these things. And I would love for that experience to be just basically a single like download and the app is running. Like there should be no other input from the user. And there should be no other input in terms of staying up to date than at that point. You should never, you know, if you close the app, it should update itself in the background. And the next time you run it, it should be the new version.
Yeah, I think that whole model of install on shutdown or install so the next time you run it is beautiful. Like there's paint.net does that really well. It's always frustrating when it's like, hey, there's a new version. You're stuck. Don't you make a decision now, right when you want to use my app.
Yep.
You know, whether you're going to update or not. Well, of course not. I want to do some work, you know. I watch my wife do this all the time. She always closes the update things because it's like, I don't want to update now. Like, yep.
So. And eventually I'd like to get to the place where, you know, we have that little blue arrow now. Eventually you shouldn't even really know about that. Like it honestly shouldn't. It shouldn't matter, and it should be pretty transparent that anything is happening at all. It's like reloading a web page. You have no idea if you just got a new version of the website. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, that's kind of the ultimate place that desktop apps get. And in many ways, I think is my biggest problem with, you know, the App Store mentality of distribution, specifically coming from Apple, but Android is bad. And honestly, I haven't played with the Windows Store too much yet, but I would imagine there's a lot of clicking and acknowledging, and then you still have to go back to this central application in order to check for updates. To me, that's a terrible way to do that for a desktop application.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so far, and I'm no Windows 8 expert, but there's a store thing and it shows a number on it that shows how many updates, but it's
still just what you need, right?
Exactly.
Another number of things to do. What? It's like this...
A work list.
We're like inventing work for people. I hate that on my iPhone, like having to see that there are 10 updates. Install them when I don't care. Right. You know, maybe when it's plugged in and on a charger so it doesn't drain my battery, but figure it out for me.
I think Zach Coleman, one of our coworkers, had a really great blog post about that. It basically, I think the title was, don't make me do the shit work, right? Mm-hmm. Like the whole point of computers and software is to automate a lot of the crap we don't want to do. And then instead what developers do is we create these new chores for you to do. And it's kind of like Farmville, actually. And a lot of them sort of tap into this real primal part of your brain where you get addicted to, you know, oh, look, new updates, click, click, click. And you know, you realize that you're not actually getting joy. It's your hit of heroin. Got to click update on all the little updates, click, click, click.
But then on the other hand, people get upset when Microsoft just pushes down updates automatically. And they don't have any say in it.
And that, I think, is cultural and is, you know, driven by larger organizations and enterprises. I think that is changing.
And crappier updates, too.
In the consumer. And crappier updates. And
yeah. That require reboots or, if it's painless, nobody cares.
Right. If it's, you know, I get totally pissed off at that in Windows when Windows is like shutting down in 10 minutes. And you're like, no, come on. Like, I'm in the middle of fixing something. Leave me alone right now, you know? So there's just got to be a way to get out of, you know, I don't sit at my computer 24 hours a day. So there is a large period of time where you could intelligently do things. And I probably wouldn't know the difference that you, even if you had to reboot yourself, I probably wouldn't know the difference if it started up again.
Yeah, honestly, the Windows 8 version of that is a lot nicer. I mean, it gives me like a 3-day heads up, like, hey, I'm going to reboot in the next 3 days, or you can do it, you know, next shutdown, we'll install updates. It actually does not piss me off.
I don't know, because if you ignore that, then it's like eventually you'll get to a point where it'll just pop up a dialogue that says like Windows is starting back up. Windows is restarting in 5 minutes. It shows like a countdown, like it's a bomb. and it's like, sorry, we're restarting. There's no way to cancel that. Like, unlike Windows 7 where you could postpone it. But I think going back a little But the other problem is that updates on Windows are never good, right? I mean, they're never, you don't get features from updates. Like, there's no carrot, right? There's
it's like
sticks.
Java or Flash it's, updates.
At best, it'll do exactly what it did before. Like, at worst, something that worked before now doesn't. There's no advantage to updating. And I think that's one thing that Windows kind of, they took this policy a while back. I used to work in Windows servicing in Hotfix, and they decided that there's, you know, stop shipping features and specs, which was in one hand, like, reasonable. But on the other hand, it's like now people have this opinion of updates, right? Because nothing ever good, you know, you don't get a little like feature, like this thing that worked kind of weird works a little bit better now, right? Like that never happened. And they guaranteed it not to happen. Whereas if like you're getting like, yeah, this updated and then, you know, now it does something a little bit better, right? You know, people would kind of look at it a little differently. Like you kind of, updates are in on iPhone are like a little bit exciting because, you know, when you update, something might be a little bit better, right? Like they add features. So
I also think it heavily dependent on what is being updated, because if you look at like application code bases, there's code that has tons of arrows pointing in, which by that I mean other sims that depend on that thing working. And then there are the edge nodes, right? The leaf nodes. So if, you know, your Chrome updates automatically, you know, you're probably not, your mission critical sims are probably not down because of that. But if like the core.NET framework has a bug in an update, then, you know, all the code that you have written against that suddenly crash and dies, right? So, you know, I think on that regard, like, you can have a policy that sort of fits the type of software it is, you know? And I think that's where the pain is, like, you can't treat it all as one size fits all.
Yep.
If Windows goes down or if Exchange goes down, that's a significant impact on yours versus, you know, if GitHub for Windows, you know, changes the way the feature works, probably not, it's not the end of the world for your business.
Yeah.
So, Phil, you came out of the web world. You were kind of living in the web world for a long time. Now we're working in the rich client world. How has that transition been for you?
It's a big bit of a challenge. So, you know, starting from day one at GitHub, we're pretty much using, like these guys have mentioned, WPF, Reactive Extensions, Reactive UI, Caliburn Micro, all these different libraries. And it was quite a change of pace for me, but I started liking certain things, though. I've noticed that the separation of concerns you can get with XAML and an MVVM framework like Caliburn Micro and Reactive UI is really quite good. So much so that, you know, I rarely write XAML because I spend a lot of my time working with view models. And it's kind of great to see I can write all this, you know, unit tests, write all this view model code, and then, you know, let one of the other guys handle all that, wiring things up, you know, code. And it all comes out really well. And so that part I really like, you know, it took getting used to how XAML works. It's a little, I'm actually a fan of HTML and CSS and JavaScript. But one thing that was kind of a pain for me is that it was very clear to me, and this was something that, you know, I tried to push for very early on in Microsoft. I was part of a test-driven development working group that we were trying to push better testability across the entire .NET framework. And as you probably know, it had a big impact in ASP.NET, but it was very difficult to get a lot of these other groups to really care. And so WPF, I think, shows that in that, you know, a lot of things really hard to test. I mean, so many things are sealed that really have no reason to be sealed or only have internal constructors. So that part I found to be a little painful, but community provided the testability pieces that were completely missing from the core WPF framework. And so I think that's a real great example of the open source community stepping in to fill a void that, you know, Microsoft did, you know, went halfway or a quarter way, and then they came in and, you know, went the rest of the way.
So, Phil, you mentioned a few of the libraries, and as I was looking through this, there's a lot of cool libraries in here, and I wonder if you guys can just kind of mention, like, okay, so there's Reactive, which we talked about, Caliburn Micro, which is cool, and we've done shows on that before. There's CEF Sharp, there's Markdown, there's Nustache, and N-Mustache, whatever, Newtonsoft, JSON. Anything else or any more you want to talk about just as far as cool libraries? And
sure, I'll cover a few and I'll let Paul. Seth Sharp is actually something that Paul did that's based off Chromium Embedded Framework, so he can talk about that. Naturally, we use libgit2 and libgit2 Sharp. So those are open source frameworks that are, you know, for Axe and Git. And I'm actually, we have a licenses dialogue in the application, so you can actually, you know, go through and see the list of all the licenses and all the frameworks that we're using. And there are quite a bit of open source libraries. I think it's one of the fun things about working outside is that it's very easy to use third-party open source software. Jeez, it's a lot.
Yeah, we make heavy use. REST Sharp, we use quite a bit. And JSON.NET, I think you mentioned, because we make pretty good use of the GitHub API V3 and being able to pull those in there. And I think most of the other ones were pretty well covered there. We already talked about PoshGit. I think we do some interesting things in kind of mashing up Caliburn Micro and Reactive UI. I wonder if post-launch we should push some of those little bits back to the community. We basically kind of taken the screens, you know, the screens and the conductor pattern in Caliburn and made them all reactive. They're all reactive objects in our kind of mashup of those two frameworks. So
yeah, and there's probably a couple of little libraries that I want to extract from the application and make open as separate open source libraries. You know, we did a lot of unit tests with xunit.net and mock-u, and so you know, we had to write a file system abstraction. Just wasn't happy with the ones out there because they were either based on older APIs in the framework, and for example, returning string arrays for directories instead of an enumerable. And so, you know, we started writing our own file system abstraction and a couple other things like that that I think others will find useful. So, you know, once I have some time, I hope to turn those into some libraries. And I know Paul has, like you mentioned, he released Akavash's library. So we hope to extract and kind of deliver a lot of really cool libraries for people building similar types of apps and have similar needs.
So Phil, you mentioned testing a little bit in there. Can you talk a little bit more about how you guys did testing, both unit testing and integration testing?
Sure. So we use xunit.net for all our unit tests and our integration tests. We split it into two different projects. One, the integration, because we're dealing with Git, we really want to make sure we test code going against actual Git repositories. Because the last thing you want to do is have all these unit tests and find out that it doesn't actually work when it integrates with the real world. But, you know, when I came in, I really pushed for having really tight unit tests that really did abstract everything away and just tested the units, because they're going to run a lot faster and you know, we'll get pretty decent code coverage with that. So we, you know, I made a concerted effort to try to get all that going. And as I mentioned earlier, MVVM, the model view, view model pattern really lends itself to that. The other thing we do is we use Janky, which is a continuous integration server that's integrated with Hubot. And Hubot is our friendly neighborhood robot, a campfire bot. So anytime we push to a new branch or push to master, Janky will build that branch and then report back into campfire with a message saying, yeah, you know, this successful or no, it wasn't. And we can also run builds from our chat. And I really love that aspect of it. I love that it builds every brand.
Yeah, I think
kind of useful.
What Phil said there, just encouraging people to experiment in branches. Like, we have a very branch heavy workflow at GitHub, especially since branches are so tied to pull requests. And this idea of being able to, you know, take a fork of the code and go potentially implement something new or try out a fix for a bug. And as soon as you push that to the server, have an immediate, you know, kind of red light, green light status on that branch, I think really kind of changes the way your development works, not having to be like, I got to go into CI and like set up configuration and all that kind of stuff. You know, if that status and that feedback immediately there, someone else is much more likely to then go, you know, check out your branch and run the tests and, you know, see if they contribute or help you get the last mile there to integrate that into the main line.
Yeah, I mean, I used to use cruisecontrol.net before, and you know, every time we want to create a new branch, and this is when I was using the version, and it'd be like, oh my god, it's such a big deal, you know, and you know, oh, I got to go in the fig and copy this bit of XML over here, and you know, Git really encourages like just branch, you know, branch per feature, branch per, you know, little thing. I mean, just make a lot of branches because it's easy to merge back together. And combined, as Tim mentioned, combined with Janky, you know, we'll actually get a continuous integration for those branches, which, yeah, like I said, really, really nice.
And have you guys been dog fooding? I mean, do you try to do all your own Git, you know, commits and stuff using GitHub for Windows?
Absolutely. So I've been writing a few side projects, and I always make it a point to use GitHub for Windows. And even though I use the command line quite a bit, one thing that I actually like better than the command line is the way that we stage the files to be committed. Like, so the way that I kind of work is not very disciplined, in the sense that I'll, like a lot of different other programmers, you know, I'll just open Visual Studio and then do a bunch of different things that are kind of unrelated and then come back and then commit it all, right? So like type, and then come back and make like four different commits. And I think that doing that, selecting like which files to be committed and then typing up the message and then hitting submit is way easier to do in GitHub for Windows, because you can just go really quickly and select like, okay, these four files commit, these two files commit. All right, all the rest commit is something else, right? And so in that sense, I actually find it more convenient than using the command line and trying to type like 15 git add statements to make before I can get what I want staged. So yeah, I try to use it for a lot of, I've used it on like, I think like three little applications now, and it's worked really well. I really like it.
I use it pretty heavily I use GitHub for Windows for developing GitHub for Windows, which can be sort of painful sometimes because you're pulling from a server and you're merging in changes, and then Visual Studio, you know, basically needs to reload everything because you're running the project that you're using to commit the project. But it's been I think that's been one of the things that just running the private beta, we've had a couple hundred people involved in this private beta, has been hugely important to us, really, as GitHub being an Apple, a Unix, a Ruby shop. Windows is a little bit foreign here to a lot of people. And we've had a lot of people at GitHub check it out and play with it and turn on VMs and mess with the app. But I would say, you know, outside the core kind of team of four of us working on it here, nobody else at GitHub actually like turns on Windows on a daily basis for any real reason. So the beta group has been hugely helpful in validating things and having people have a variety of configurations and use their repositories in ways.
Okay, so I gotta ask about line ending. This has been like a point of contention.
Yeah,
especially
let's talk about line endings.
Let's talk about line endings, guys.
I hate line endings are my Vietnam. I'm gonna throw that out there. I think that we finally solved this in a way that is not pushy, but a little bit pushy. And so what we do to solve the line ending problem, and really the core of the line ending problem is that there are two settings on Git handle how it deals with line endings and text, how it parses text. There's auto CRLF true, which means that on Windows, when you check out a file, it's going to be CRLF line endings. But when you check it in, it's going to store it as line feed, right? As something that is kind of more native to Git. And the reason being is that when you go check it out on a Mac box, you'll get the line ending setting that Mac prefers. And if you check it out on a Linux box, you'll get the line ending setting that Linux, right? The native line, so to say. Or you can say auto CRLF false and say like, Git, why are you messing with my line endings? Just commit exactly the bytes that I gave you and don't change anything. And so there's big debate. In general, Git works better if you set it with true and the default true. But the trick is that there's no right answer to this question. Because the problem is the correct answer to auto CRLF is whatever the original guy created it with. Because if, regardless of your opinion, if you set it to true and the guy created the repo as false, then you'll mess it up. And same way backwards, right? And there's no it used to be that there's no indication in the repo itself what it was set up as, right? And so really there was no sane way to solve this. So in recent versions of Git, there is a sane way to solve this via a file called git attribute. So it's like a dot file like gitignore that you put in the root of your directory, and then it lets you set up essentially describe what is a text file, it's a binary file, and what line endings those text files should have, right? Or should you use auto CRLF or not? And so now you can check in a file that describes how the repo is set up, and so now other people checking in, it'll just do it automatically correctly, right? But a lot of repos don't have that. And so the way that GitHub for Windows solves this is that if you don't have a gitignore or a git attributes and you go into settings, we'll give you a default one that's really good. Like a really like it's set up for Windows developers. It sets your gitignore. And more importantly, what it does is it actually analyzes the repo itself. So it does some statistics on the existing files in your repo and determines whether the original author set auto CRLF true or false. And so it rigs your git attributes file to match what the repo has. And so basically you'll open settings and then look at it and say like, oh, that looks good. Hit save. And now when other people contribute to your project, you're not going to see them mess up the line endings and you get this weird pull request that has all these changes where nothing has changed. Or like another symptom is when you check out or clone down a repository and instantly says a whole bunch of files are changed. Hopefully, as people use GitHub for Windows, this git attributes file becomes more pervasive because we're setting it up for you, this problem will go away. So I'm fingers crossed, but I think we've come up with a solution that is not as invasive as we're going to create a file in your directory and check it in for you. But we still are making it so you don't really have to think about it. You're just like, open a dialog and then commit this file and then you're done. So
I have a big blog post on this subject. And ultimately, I think, you know, the original point of debate comes down to a poor implementation in Git. And the first implementation of this was really that core.autoCRLF setting. And the fault of the implementation is that that setting doesn't travel with repository. And so you, as a repo owner, when you share that repository with other people, you don't get to control what their autoCRLF setting is. It could be whatever it is in their system. And so they then have the potential ability to basically corrupt your repository. And so everybody ends up fighting over, oh, I don't want my line end to change. I do want them to change. Or I never want to talk to a Unix system. So of course, I never want line. And it was ultimately the wrong way to go about solving a problem. That system is actually quite old now, but unfortunately, nobody really knows about the new system. And the new system is what Paul was describing, which is a Git attributes file in which you basically put something that is committed in the repository that describes how you want to manage line in repository. And for projects that are solely on Windows, it honestly doesn't matter. You can check in CRLF, you can check in LF, you can do whatever you want. For projects that are cross-platform in nature, it actually really makes a lot of sense in order to make sure that the core database is just using line feeds. And a lot of times people get into trouble because you copy and paste code off the internet. And so you end up getting, you know, you copied a piece of sample code on your Mac and you pasted it in and that accidentally had a line feed is with a carriage return or maybe just a carriage return. And so you end up with these weird mixes of things in there that then it just simply reduces the ability to communicate about the code because now the diff between the versions looks like you changed a lot more than you actually did. And so it's not necessarily harmful to the code base, but it's harmful in the communication about the base. So Git attributes, that's what everybody should have, a .git attributes file, especially Windows developing. They are most susceptible to running into problems.
And in the future, one of the things that we're thinking about or I think would be really useful is that once you get into this scenario, it's hard to get out of it. Like if you mess up a repo and half check in line feeds or something like that, or if you check in some files that are UTF-16, like Unicode files, whereas Git really likes UTF-8 files. And so one of the things we're thinking about doing is writing kind of a repair tool so that you can, so you don't have to know about any of this stuff or figure out how to fix it, because repairing it actually is not very easy if you're not really handy with VI, basically. And so one thing we're thinking about doing is just writing like a repair tool to just fix this for you. So like if we try to prevent it, but if you do end up with kind of a messed up repo, then we can just clean it.
Okay. I have one more question, and this is not GitHub for Windows specific, but it's GitHub-y. You guys are GitHubers, so I'll see if you have a perspective. There was some news in the last couple weeks about how Linus Torvalds, the author of Git, had some less than complimentary things to say about GitHub pull requests. And I'm curious if people over at GitHub are listening to that and taking those into consideration.
Who's this guy? We were kind of surprised when Linus turned around and he actually started using Site. I think the kernel.org went down and he was upset. And so he was like, fine, I'm, you know, 4 years into this, I'm going to go check out this GitHub thing. And he and the kernel developers have never really been too hot on the idea of using the web. You know, why would anybody want to like talk about code on the web? Like mailing lists are the future. And so we were a little bit surprised even that he bothered to take a look. And he immediately came back with all of this feedback, you know, oh, I can't see this in my emails and all of this. And we actually made a significant number of changes the very day that Linus started using GitHub. We actually made, you know, half a dozen or so changes, not only to GitHub.com, but to the format of the emails that you get surrounding pull requests and that kind of stuff that were literally steered by Linus himself. I mean, it was direct feedback from him. So we're definitely listening, but he's also not the primary audience of GitHub. In many ways, I think part of what GitHub has done is taken this command line tool, which was very complex and understandable by a small number of people to work on a very specific project, and been able to bring the base collaboration model of distributed version control to a huge audience. And so I think there are always some compromises in doing that. I'm not so sure that you can always appease everybody. You got to take a stance somewhere. And I think we're pretty committed to making it easy to collaborate on open source and providing interfaces that maybe aren't as fully functional as all of your command line switches and options, but bring people into, you know, being good stewards to open source and collaborating great stuff on GitHub and other places in the world.
The thing that I appreciate, though, about Linus Torvalds is that while he's pretty harsh by any description, all of the things that he complained about were actionable things. It wasn't like you see people rant on the internet and you're just like, they say it with like, this sucks. Like, you know, what am I supposed to do with that? It's like, oh, great. I guess I'll just stop doing what I'm doing then. You know, but every single thing that he complained about was a reasonable complaint. And they're very specific and actionable. And I think that was, for some guy that's as busy as him to call out and take all the time to write this huge write-up, I think it means that, like, I don't think that, you know, if you don't care about something, you just say nothing, right? Like, if you thought that GitHub was universally bad, why would he even bother talking, right? But because he took the time to, like, criticize it, I think that it's something that he's interested in using. And I think that all of the things that he pointed out are things that we could either consider or they're definitely something we can improve. Like, the way that we send out pull request emails, we could totally do better on that. So I actually really appreciated him writing all these things up, even though he's calling us all morons. But
okay, any last questions for anybody?
You know what we should point out, if you want to check out GitHub for Windows, go to windows.github.com. There'll be a little green button on the top right. Click that and it'll run you through the click once experience and get GitHub for Windows on your machine. And you don't need to worry. We're not going to mess with your PaaS or environment or anything like that. I think someone mentioned it, we're sandboxed. So if you have an existing installation of Git or whatever, we're not going to screw with that. We're not going to mess with that. What we do put on your machine is two shortcuts, one for GitHub for Windows, which is the GUI application, and one labeled Git Shell. And what that does is that will run the shell that you configure within GitHub for Windows. So if you go to GitHub for Windows, click Options, there's a default shell setting. And by default, we use PowerShell, but you can change it to Command or Bash, or you can do custom. So for example, I use console2. And then when you launch the Git shell for shortcut, we'll actually launch the default shell, but configured with all the default settings that we mentioned, so that you don't have to worry about all that stuff, and you'll be able to use the command line like that. So it's safe to install, won't screw anything up, but go get it now.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on, guys, and join us again next time for another episode of Herding Code.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you. Very interesting.
Scott, are you doing this call from the freeway? Are you, like, driving on the freeway?
Yep, basically, yeah. Technically, it's an avenue, but...
Well, then, can you mute the whole call?
John, do you have your road noise filter?
I thought you did that in post-production.
Here, I do it in pre-production by hanging up on you.
I can mute for the entire call, or I can whenever I'm not talking.
Yeah, I guess if you unmute when you're not talking, I can filter a lot out. But if there's road noise during the whole thing, that's a mess.
Wait, what?
Exactly.
I'm not talking.
Okay. Wait, no.
Other way around.
Right.
How about if I mute when I'm talking? Is that better?
I'm gonna hang up on you.
Jesus, quality bar.